Omnibus is a production of iHeartRadio.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 867.NU1105, certificate number 25671, the Onion Futures Act.
Now.
South Dakota in April of 142!
That's not right. How can the price be going down?
Something's wrong. Where's Wilson?
What are they doing here?
They're selling, Mortimer.
Well, that's ridiculous.
You're a person I think of as fairly financially savvy. You manage a portfolio, don't you?
I guess. I have all the game show money somewhere.
You made money and you tucked it away in various places?
It's tucked. It's not in a mattress.
Right.
It's in imaginary places that would all be vaporized if the EMP pulse hits.
Right. I mean, well, no, you bought a house, so you own some real estate.
That's true.
But then the rest of it is spread around some sort of stock funds, I'm guessing.
Yes, and I say things like securities,
and
commodities,
right?
Like I know what they are, but I really kind of don't.
Do you know what a commodity is?
A commodity is different than a security.
Yes,
because it's a thing. It's like some kind of crop or product, right?
A crop.
It's not a share in a corporation or enterprise.
No, what defines a commodity is that it is a product, right? Like you were saying, a crop or a mineral, but something where it is it's fungible, which is to say that it's produced multiple places around the world, and all those different versions of it are, as far as the market or a consumer is concerned, is the same.
So if I buy tin,
right,
I'm not buying Amalgamated Tin Company of New Hampshire.
You don't care if it came from South Africa or Russia.
All tin is tin if I own tin.
All tin is tin. All wheat is wheat.
I like that. It's like Catan or Pit or something.
Yeah. Those games are based on commodities.
Oh, trading. It's not the other way around? Commodities trading is not based on settlers of Catan.
Based on settlers of Catan. And so commodities are different, for instance, from, say, like VCRs, because even though VCRs still exist and they're still a major force in the stock market, but a Sony VCR and a Philips VCR have elements, including their brand, including different perceptions in consumers about value.
And maybe proprietary variation or technology.
So that a Sony VCR, although it does the same thing as a Philips VCR.
Unless it's a beta.
A Sony VCR could inexplicably be, it could cost $150 more. So although you could base, you could, there's an element of VCRs that perform as commodities because they are mass produced and they are more or less interchangeable. But the element, adding the additional element of brand, and this is also true, for instance, of eggs, right? Eggs are kind of produced universally.
Not by me.
Well, No.
By chickens.
No. Well, not just
and
chickens.
And anything with an ovary.
Yeah, that's right. Your wife is producing eggs.
How do you know that?
Even as we speak.
Thank you for that nice compliment.
Oh, no, no,
Ken,
no.
Your wife's not in menopause yet.
That's not true. She produced all her eggs. They were already produced in her when she was born.
She came out of the box like that.
Yeah.
All if you're a futurelings, if you are a species that has ovaries,
right.
What that means is any offspring you ever have is out there right now
right.
in your future partner's ovary.
Unless futurelings have evolved an ovary that produces eggs on demand. Maybe futurelings are able to say, I want an egg with a long that produces an offspring with a long proboscis.
It would certainly be convenient, but the bottom would fall out of the feminine hygiene industry. Mm. I mean, if you're thinking about commodities markets, just think how that invention would hurt, Always or Tampax. If you can just produce one egg when you want to ovulate and nothing else otherwise.
Unless futurelings are sentient tampons.
I feel like a lot of our fans are sentient tampons.
But so that is what that is kind of how a commodity is described. And a lot of things are sort of imperfect commodities, like an egg, for instance. Like most consumers just want an egg. If you go into a restaurant and you order eggs, you don't care whether those eggs came from South Africa or Russia.
Right.
But there are eggs that are cage-free, range-free, and as a consumer, you're willing to pay more for a kind of egg. So even though eggs function as commodities, they're imperfect. There are eggs that have qualities that change their value.
Is there a name for that?
I think within a overarching conception of commodities, there's a recognition that there are commodities that are purer commodities than others. So it's an imperfect description.
So let's say I go to a sports card show where some weirdos have card tables and they're selling sports cards. Now, at the end of the weekend, they'll sell them by the box and those become pure commodities. They're not good ones, but it's like, here's a box of baseball cards. Effectively, they're all the same.
You're not going to find a Ken Griffey Jr.
Right.
First year card.
But are the nice cards that they have on the tables face up at the beginning of the weekend, would those count as a commodity? Or
no, those are
okay.
Those are
they're actually just items.
They're items.
You can't because you couldn't invest in that. I mean, you could invest in each particular one.
You invest in a card, but not in the mass of cards.
Right. They don't become a commodity until they come out of the cardboard box in volume at the end of the weekend.
Yeah, that's right.
I like to understand all economic
things in terms of
sports card sales at a local middle school. That's what I'm into.
Well, and what's interesting about commodities, like for instance, gold. I mean, gold is a commodity to the degree that you can throw gold from all around the world into the same little smelting pot and smelt it down, and it's still gold.
Gold's gold.
Gold is gold.
Chemically, it's the same thing.
What's additionally interesting about commodities is that the price of them is variable or fluctuates according to supply and demand, but not to any specific producer of it. So, for instance, a gold market or a wheat market becomes a global market. The price of that commodity is determined by, I mean, obviously it's hard to transport that Australian wheat right. to America, but that's part of a commodities exchange. For most commodities, it is the price of them is determined across the entire commodity.
Geography doesn't come into play. It doesn't matter that even if Australia has too much wheat, it would be too expensive to get it to the American market, so we can count it out. Is that a innovation of the flatter world of the 20th century?
Yeah, it changes. It has changed very much in the 20th century. For instance, there is a global price of gold.
But gold's an easy example because there's just not that much gold, right? All the gold ever mined on Earth would fit in a cube 20 feet wide or something. Have you heard this thing?
Yeah. Like,
there's just not that much gold out there.
It's great, right?
Is that great to you?
I think it is great because every time you get a piece of gold,
you're like, where does this go in the cube?
Yeah, you're like, this is part of the cube. Maybe they can't make the cube without me now.
Maybe this goes on an edge. Uh-huh. Maybe it's somewhere in the middle. Uh-huh. It's like a puzzle piece.
Right. The cube just sits with a little corner missing, and that's the piece of gold I have here in my mother's wedding ring.
And then Scrooge McDuck dives around in it.
But because commodities... because the prices fluctuate, and some of it is to do with the fact that wheat in Australia may be flourishing today and wheat in America was all hit with a plague of some kind. I mean, commodities, in a way, in recent years, we've extended commodities even to include energy. And we'll get to that in a second. But, like, you know, you can buy and sell electricity now. And electricity is an interesting commodity because although you would think all electricity was more or less the same, you can, in fact, stipulate that the electricity you are buying on an electricity market was produced by solar or wind. And so people are willing to pay more for renewable electricity.
Just out of social conscience.
Yeah, that's right. So it becomes, I mean, like the sort of social aspect of consumerism is now kind of changing the way commodities markets.
But that's not true of tin yet. There's no cage-free tin. It's probably true of diamonds, where people will pay more for non-West African blood diamonds, right?
Sure they will, yeah.
What about pork bellies? Why is it always bellies?
Well,
that's what I want to know.
So
everything should have belly. All commodities should end with belly.
So we'll,
and then gold bellies. I'm in oil bellies.
We'll get to bellies in a second.
Okay, that's what they always say, and then they never do.
No.
You better get back to it.
For sure, we're going to talk about bellies today. Okay. So commodities trading, it kind of has two aspects to it. A commodity like wheat has what's called a price today. Right. If you want a bushel of wheat, you're willing to pay today's price.
If I'm really hungry, maybe I'll pay too much.
Well, but there is a set price for wheat today, tomorrow. You know, wheat is $10 a bushel right now, let's say.
Okay.
And so if you go to someone and say, I would like to buy this quantity of wheat, there's a price you're willing to pay in today's market, which is called the spot price. So if wheat is $10 a bushel, you go to somebody that has wheat to sell and you say, I'll pay you $10 for this, and you pay this spot price for it.
Which has kind of been decided by the market through a series of other transactions.
That's right. And within a day or two, they have to produce this wheat for you at that price.
But what if I'm hungry now?
Well, you would go to the store if you're hungry. We're talking about trading commodities as a way of moving these goods around.
I don't ever want the wheat at my house. I just want their ownership rights to a certain amount of all the wheat in the world.
Presumably in this example, you're just buying the wheat in order to make bread or something. You have some industrial use for it.
Okay.
So that's the spot price, which is the sort of immediate price. But because commodity availability and need fluctuate,
supply and demand.
That's right. There is also something called the futures market, or the price of a commodity at some point in the future. And this is also called the derivatives market, which is to say, right now, if you're a farmer and you have planted a field of wheat, that wheat isn't going to mature. You're not going to be able to sell that until the wheat is harvested.
Right.
And so you're looking ahead and you're trying to gauge your year. You're trying to say, like, oh, I have to pay for my children's college. I have to buy a new combine. And a lot of things could happen to your field of wheat between now and when it's harvested and ready to sell. You could be hit with a storm and your wheat crop could be destroyed. But also your neighbors could all be producing fantastic crop of wheat, and suddenly the market is at harvest time full of incredible wheat, and naturally that will drop the overall price of wheat.
It could go the other way, right? Like something awful could happen to all the wheat in China and prices could go up.
And your wheat could be worth a ton of money. Uh-huh. That's right. And so as a farmer at the beginning of the year, you're thinking, the last thing I want is to have my wheat destroyed or the market crash and I lose the value of this wheat. Mm-hmm. Because the spot price of this wheat right now, I could, if it remained the same, I could make a predictable decision about my financial well-being a year from now.
And so the futures market exists to eliminate uncertainty for a person like this who would rather have... Or is it for someone else?
No. It's precisely to reduce uncertainty. And of course, the buyer of wheat also wants some predictability in their own life. If you're somebody who's making bread and you're looking at the price of wheat as a component of how you're going to produce your own crop, your own product in the form of bread, you look at the spot price now, and obviously you're hoping that it will go down by the time wheat is for sale in the fall, but also you definitely don't want the price of wheat to skyrocket because it affects your own financial fortunes. So what a futures market does in a kind of ideal situation is that both parties agree to settle on a price that they're willing to pay for wheat at harvest time, even though we're way up in the year. And if you can settle on that price, it reduces your risk. It reduces risk for both parties.
Somebody's probably going to lose a little on one side or another, and somebody's going to gain a little on one side or another.
Right. If wheat goes up a little or down a little, which is typical in a normal market, neither party really wins or loses except by fractions. They're both protected against an incredibly volatile market. Now, if the price of wheat skyrockets, the farmer might regret having sold all of his wheat at a spot price from 9 months ago. And the buyer will rejoice because in purchasing futures, he's given himself a competitive advantage against all the other people that are making bread.
This is not unlike an eBay transaction where someone sells a Filson leather bag at a price that is a little too low and then realizes after the fact that they sold this to, say, Seattle musician John Roderick at a price that's too low and then tries to weasel out of the sale a little.
Then they send me some emails that are like, wow, you got a really good deal on this bag that I just sold you that I didn't realize was worth this much money.
You're buying Filson futures.
That's right.
You did get the bag, though, and it looks great.
Thank you very much. I'm glad you appreciate it. Not everyone would.
It's a lovely garment bag.
But of course, like anything that's traded, the future market can also become a space for speculators. Someone who has no actual interest in wheat beyond just as a commodity.
And the occasional bagel.
They have an interest in the wheat that you make into bread, but they themselves are just using it as a financial instrument.
This is what, so I first learned about derivatives trading in regards to the housing bubble of 2008 or so popping, in which case it turned out that the secondary market being created was just a bad, dumb thing that was adding no value and in fact tanked the world economy.
That's right.
So am I supposed to hate all derivatives markets for that reason?
Well, no. I mean, derivatives markets, economists argue this and still argue it today, whether or not derivatives markets actually have the effect long-term of stabilizing prices, or whether they have no effect, or whether they actually have a negative effect in terms of stabilizing prices. Like, economists like stable prices. They don't like crazy fluctuation.
Because they're boring people, or they wouldn't have become economists.
That's right. And that's the ideal situation. The ideal conditions are ones where
predictability.
Prices fluctuate, you know, according to a small sort of, but there's not a, there aren't these situations where you have a housing crisis where all the bad mortgages have been repackaged into financial instruments which are being traded.
So the problem with that was not times. That derivatives existed. It was that kind of sketchy derivatives were being created and sold to people, deceptively sold to people.
Right. But those are recent inventions. The idea of futures trading goes all the way back to ancient times. The Code of Hammurabi actually has
ingots. Are they bad ingots?
There are no bad ingots, but there is a clause within the code that deals with the idea of you know, selling a thing that will only come to fruition in the future at a current price.
It seems like a natural reaction to dealing with crops, which is one of the most common transactions you would have back then. Is you may want to sell the crop before harvest.
That's right. And an example of an early example of kind of a futures or a sort of, or what's called a sort of hedging in a market, it appears in Aristotle. He tells the story of Thales, who was a poor philosopher, but in using science, he saw in the stars and in the weather of the spring that there was going to be an extremely productive olive harvest at the end of the season.
He's the guy that thought everything was made of water, by the way. That's the only thing I know about him. He thought the universe was made of water. So why is he buying olives if he thinks they're made of water?
Well, he didn't buy olives. What he did was go around to all the owners of olive presses and contract with them that he would have the exclusive use of their press come harvest season. And so all the olive press owners were happy to lease their presses to him at what they consider to be a good price. And then when olive season
He's insider trading. He knows there's going to be a bumper crop of olives.
Well, he's not insider trading because no one in the olive business gave him that information. He's just observing conditions.
He didn't go chill in the orchards? Okay.
Well, but even if he did, he's not. Insider trading is a situation where someone within a business says, we're about to sell.
Nobody knows this. We're going to have so many olives.
Yeah. Or we just made a contract with a company that's going to double our business and you know it the day before we announce it.
Gotcha.
This is just a situation where Thales is using his brain and using what he knows about weather and harvest. And so when suddenly all the olive producers needed to press their olives to make olive oil,
they had no choice but to reckon with Thales.
Right. And he then was renting out his what effectively were his leased presses at a much greater rate. And so profited quite a bit and became
Did he set exorbitant prices? Did he gouge these poor olive farmers? I don't admire him in this story. First of all, I think the universe is made of water. Well, second of all, he's victimizing these poor olive farmers.
I think he probably behaved honorably because Aristotle praises him. Mm. And in just that, I mean, you can raise the price of something to account for fluctuations in the market to a point where it's not usurious, and past a certain point, then it becomes then a moral component enters into it. At least to liberals like us who sit and think that capitalism shouldn't be pure
and untrammeled,
but it should also take into account social factors. You don't want to alienate the entire olive growing community in Greece. You want to keep everybody happy. And also, if you're gouging olive growers, you're also, I mean, the owners of the olive presses are also going to resent you because they rented it to you at 10 shekels.
But we're really just relying on his conscience here. No market forces are requiring him not to just set the highest price he thinks the farmers can pay without just trashing their crop.
Right. Although you have to ask yourself, does your reputation as a trader have a long-term consequence, or are you just in it to short-term it?
I guess that's true.
And this is part of the mortgage trade thing, and this is part of, you know, what we see in financial markets now, where corporate raiders will buy a company, shut it down, and sell all its assets for a short-term profit, but leave sort of community devastation in their wake, and they're the Michael Milkins of the world who are reviled.
It's happening to a lot of retail in our era. Futurelings, like a lot of businesses that could otherwise stay in business, it turns out to one person, some hedge fund manager, it's more profitable just to shut down Toys R Us or Sears or whatever, even if they could make a go of it.
Right.
So places that otherwise would not, you know, could be a going concern are on the chopping block due to these markets.
And you look at situations like Sears, where as a retail concern, they're not extremely profitable, but then someone realizes that Sears is one of the major property owners in America.
It's a lot of real estate.
They own incredible real estate, sometimes right in the heart of downtowns. And if you buy Sears as a failing commercial enterprise, you get this real estate at a bargain. But so the idea of this kind of futures market existed for, you know, since ancient times.
Futures have existed since the past.
And will presumably continue into the future unless the early 20th century American political scene eliminates all capitalism and we become a world.
A utopian world.
Where from each according to his ability, to each according.
It's going
to
be sad for all those finance guys. They seem so nice. Finance, you know, the one thing I know about young finance guys, they're all super cool.
Well, what about when you go down to Main Street and you meet with your local banker who knows you by name and extends you a loan?
He gives you a toaster for opening an account.
Extends you a loan to buy a new combine.
Love it.
In the United States, futures trading, and throughout most of history, futures trading was connected to commodities, real commodities. Like, I mean, and even the use of an olive press is within the, you know, it's in the concrete world, and it isn't necessarily that any one olive press is making a better olive oil than any other.
Right.
Chicago, because it was the location, it was central to the agricultural world of 19th century America. Chicago became the
hog butcher to the world? City of Big Shoulder?
That's right. Both things and more. But also the center of commodities trading in the United States and in the world. And originally, the commodities exchange in Chicago was called the Chicago Butter and Egg Board.
Those were the main things.
I mean, butter and eggs, man. And this was before free-range eggs, back when eggs were just a commodity.
Sounds more like a chocolate chip cookie recipe than a financial institution.
The Chicago Butter and Egg Board, it actually sounds like one of these restaurants where you can only get pickled pickles and a little bit of fish.
All the drinks come in mason jars.
The Chicago Butter and Egg Board morphed into the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and they were trading in sort of, I guess, what you would consider your regular commodities, like cattle and hogs,
pork
and
bellies,
milk.
We're finally getting to pork bellies, like,
well,
you promised.
We're not quite to pork bellies.
Fine.
So fast forward to the aftermath of World War II. The country is booming, and commodities are in demand all around. The financial institutions, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, everybody's flourishing.
It now sounds like a bubblegum band to me. I love the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Yeah, right. Well, from the 60s, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Quick server, messenger service.
Their first record was amazing.
But in the mid-50s, a couple of onion farmers by the name of Sam Siegel and Vincent Kasuga.
Okay.
Realized, I mean, they were kind of onion farmers and also dabbling as onion traders. They started to try to game the system a little bit.
Game the onion system.
Game the onion system. And onions were a commodity that were traded, like a lot of produce. Mm-hmm. But onions had become a major commodity on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Because they're so delicious.
They're very delicious. They are somewhat perishable. Everybody wants an onion, as we so often say.
that old saying.
Yeah, well, no, the style of the time was to put one on your belt, so you needed a fresh onion.
That's why this was such a big deal at the time. People were wearing onions around. Wait, how perishable are onions, by the way? Like, will onions stay through the winter in a root cellar like potatoes?
Well, have you ever put an onion, like
a
raw onion on the countertop and left it there for a couple of weeks?
Yeah, it gets gross. It gets all gross. Wrinkly and oozy.
And starts to ooze, right. Yeah. So Sam and Vincent decided that they were going to corner the market on onions. Now, what cornering the market is if you buy enough of a commodity that you have control over, you have control over enough of it that you can sort of set the price. You can determine the price because—
Like Thales with his olive press.
Like Thales with his olive press. He cornered the market on presses. And so Sam and Vincent had a plan to corner the market.
I looked up the etymology to see if it was some cool thing about how there was one corner of the Chicago Stock Exchange or whatever. But no, it just means like you're backing the other buyers into a corner.
Right.
You're cornering them. They have no choice but to accept your price.
And plenty of people have tried to corner markets over the years. And
I have not.
You've never tried to corner the market?
Here's some markets. I've cornered zero markets.
No, that's not true. You cornered the market on people that were winning Jeopardy for a while.
It's a very small market, and it's not publicly traded.
go ahead. What were you about to say?
Oh, no, nothing. You just said many people have tried to corner the market. I thought you had interesting examples.
Well, I do. Many financial people have tried to corner the market. And in the 19th century in America, which was this boom time, there were a lot of— it was somewhat fashionable for the robber baron class to try to corner the market on something, because you can see that it has a certain appeal, right? I'm the one that owns all the pork bellies, as you say.
All the cobalt.
You know, you can't get cobalt unless you come to me.
It seems unfair, though. Like, it seems like in your olive press example, you would just piss everybody off, and maybe Teddy Roosevelt would pass legislation saying, stop cornering that market, you.
Well, there was quite a bit of that. One of the more famous instances, immediately after the Civil War, during the presidency of Ulysses S. Grant, the government of the United States was considerably in debt because they'd spent a lot of money fighting the war that they kind of, you know, they were spending money they didn't have.
Yeah.
But what they did have was gold reserves. And so on a semi-regular basis, President Grant would sell off some of the Treasury's gold in order to pay off America's debts. And during this period, two robber barons you may have heard of, Jay Gould, a railroad magnate, right, and James Fisk, both sort of famous and somewhat famously reviled railroad barons of the mid-19th century.
Not like the cool rich people.
Not the cool ones. Not like the Carnegies and the J.P. Morgans who decided to give some of their money away.
Yeah, that's what happens. Like, I'm sure they all did awful things, but yeah. Gould and Fisk were not smart enough to put their names on any operas or museums.
Well, and it seems like Carnegie and J.P. Morgan and Rockefeller, they learned from the experience of Gould and Fisk because they came a generation later.
We get in trouble, by the way, for saying Carnegie. Do you remember this?
Oh, Carnegie.
Because you're supposed to say Carnegie.
Yeah. Well, but, I don't say Barcelona either.
But are you supposed to say Andrew Carnegie, but Carnegie Hall? Because no one's going to start saying Carnegie Hall or Carnegie Deli.
I don't know. We've talked about this before, right? The Moog synthesizer. His name is Bob Moog, even though it's spelled M-O-O-G.
A lot of people give up. Like yeah. Dr. Seuss was Dr. Seuss.
Seuss.
And people just wouldn't say like, Seuss. So he's like, whatever.
Seuss, whatever. Fine, you know.
Morons. Just buy the books, you little bastards.
I feel like Pearl Jam just wanted to be a band that appealed to cool kids. And then eventually they realized, it's just like Springsteen. You just appeal to everybody now. You can't stop it.
I've said that Springsteen was cheesy, but I don't mean in a bad way, by the way.
No. The good kind of cheesy. Like what? Billy Joel.
Exactly.
Now I'm
going to get in worse trouble.
When I'm with musicians, I will say Moog. Oh, I'm getting some cool Moog sounds on this record. But if I'm with lay people, I'll say Moog because it's only a 50% chance that they'll know what I'm talking about if I say Moog. If I say Moog,
0%.
Zero. Nobody knows.
Unless it's me.
Yeah, but you're hip.
I have a like I know a guy who runs a board game company whose name is also Moog, M-O-O-G, but he pronounces it Moog.
Sure,
he like does. He's either given up or his branch of the family always did it wrong.
Yeah,
or.
I feel like well, you know, Jennings, when you guys came to Ellis Island, it was actually Genschwein.
What if Ellis Island just changed pronunciations only? Like your name is Jennings. Still spelled Jennings.
Well, the British say Jennings.
Jennings.
But Jay Gould and James Fisk saw this a regularity in the gold market, which is that the U.S. government was releasing gold on a semi-regular, although, you know, not completely predictable basis, and that there was a gold market. And they decided they were going to try and corner the gold market. And part of the way they did this was by insider trading, by some unscrupulous behavior. They started to buy up gold. And one of them knew Grant's daughter. Maybe she was the daughter-in-law of James Fisk.
Scandal.
And so they insisted, or they asked her, they pressured her to introduce them. You know, they were these captains of industry, and they met Grant and not became friends, but, you know, they became acquaintances. Gould and Fisk knew a guy named Abel Corbin who was kind of a wheeler dealer, not a big hotshot. And Corbin's daughter or sister? No, Corbin married President Grant's sister. And so these two, Gould and Fisk, they pressured Corbin, who stood to benefit financially from their patronage, to get his wife to introduce them to Grant. And after they took advantage of this kind of association, they got close enough to Grant that they could. They were trying to get like insider info on when Grant was going to be doing a sale of, you know, when the government was going to sell gold.
Treasury gold.
And then they sent a. They sent a letter to the White House saying that gold sales at this time would adversely affect the economy to the detriment of American farmers. And it was completely made up.
They just mean to the detriment of us.
But what they were trying to do was stop the government sale, the imminent sale of gold, or the, I'm sorry, the imminent sale of gold. That's what I said.
It might be imminent as well if the U.S. government is doing it.
But in this case, the imminent sale of gold. And so the Grant White House took that letter at face value because these guys were prominent stock market types. And I'm
always believe the rich lobbyists.
That's right.
That's what I've learned.
And so they held off with their gold sale while Gould and Fisk tried to corner the market. They bought as much gold as they could, and they sort of made the world aware that they were now the gold barons. But Grant caught wind of it. There was a scandal, and Grant ordered the Treasury to release a bunch of gold onto the market. The price of gold crashed.
So then the price of Gould crashed.
And then the price of Gould and Fisk crashed. And both guys were in financial straits, but then also were investigated, prosecuted, although let off with a slap on the wrist because, of course, they were.
I'm not saying he's a Gould digger, but I love this. I love this story because I like knowing who the Ivana Trump of the 1870s is. It's it's Ulysses Grant's like ugly sister
trying to get in there. Who knows? Who knows whether she was ugly or not? I didn't search for her relative beauty in the course of this story.
I mean, to me, that wouldn't affect her value to me at all.
No, of course not. Of course not. It's really her access to President Grant.
That's all I care about. Yes. I'm the Jared Kushner of the 1870s.
But most of the attempts to corner markets in the 19th century and really throughout history have failed because it's...
Why?
Because if the fact that you're trying to corner the market gets out, people can somewhat defend against it. You know, you can... It creates hoarding, but ultimately what happens is you inflate the price, and then naturally the price crashes. As part of cornering the market, you don't navigate the way you're selling your own stock, right? If you try to profit from
the fact— Every time you profit, you're selling.
Which, that's right, you're selling.
Which lowers your cornering abilities.
Exactly. So— If you own 90% of the world's gold and it's inflated 400%, well, you can't sell it. You know, your wealth depends entirely on you keeping gold away.
That's why you've got to irradiate the gold like Goldfinger does in Fort Knox. That's genius.
That was pretty smart of Goldfinger.
He's a smart guy. I mean, he's always painting people with gold, which maybe is not smart because, like, he needed that gold. You can't corner the market if you keep painting ladies with gold.
No, I mean, what that does is create scarcity. Also, it's to put gold leaf on something, it's not that much.
Not that much. No. Also, who knows if they actually buried it on her? Maybe they scraped it off first.
Well, all you'd have to do is burn her. The gold does not burn. It would melt.
What if she doesn't want to be cremated?
She's dead.
she has no rights in this story.
Once you are dead, especially if your body is...
What if she left a do not cremate notice on her living will?
If your body is in the hands of a Bond villain, you don't have a lot of rights. Anyway, back to Kasuga and Siegel.
Did they paint any women with onions?
I think the historical record is silent on that. But they tried to corner the onion market, and here's how they did it. They started buying up onions.
That makes sense. That's exactly what I would do in their shoes.
And, you know, onions.
And did they go around saying things like, onions are delicious. Yeah, I want onions. Let's eat more.
That happened later. So onions were, onions kind of started the year at about $2.50 a bushel.
That's a good
bag.
Deal.
I guess onions are sold in bags, not bushels.
Is that true?
At the time.
Is it like a kind of a flour sack sized bag? Yeah, is that what I should be
saying? A sack of onions.
$2. That's a good deal.
$2.50 a bushel. Well, this is 1955.
Something dollars.
Right. And they buy up onions and they buy up onion futures to the point that they, at one point, control almost the entire supply of onions. They own 30 million pounds of onions.
They could turn off the onion faucet at any time, forcing Americans to eat even blander food than they were already eating in the 50s.
That's right. You couldn't make onion rings. You couldn't make, half of the Chinese food I eat, it seems like it's 3/4 onions. You order like chicken with vegetables and it's like a bunch of half-cooked onions and some Some green onions?
There's onions in a lot of stuff, and I've become aware of this because my kids don't like onions.
Onion powder goes in a lot of things. What are some things that onions are in?
Soups.
They're on every cheeseburger.
Chicken pot pie. Yeah, burgers.
Right.
Sometimes sandwiches have them.
It turns out onions are a major, major food. And it depends on whether you call them a food or a condiment. That will come up later in the story.
Oh, yeah, because on hot dogs, you actually would use them as a condiment.
Right. Well, and you also, I mean, onions on a burger.
But I think of them in I think of them as a recipe ingredient. I'm going to vote food here. Right. Just letting you know in advance. This is a futures market for what I'm going to call onions.
But what Siegel and Kasuga did was then they went to onion growers who still had some onions on the vine. And onions don't grow on vines.
I'm almost certain onions don't grow on vines.
On the vine is just a youth. It's a term of art.
In the ground. It's like boots on the ground.
They said, listen, we're going to flood the market with onions.
Literally.
Crashing the price of onions. Unless you, onion growers, buy back these onions.
Have you always wanted to learn to play an instrument? Maybe you've even tried at some point, but gave up because you felt lessons were too expensive or that you just didn't have the time. Thankfully, there's Musician. Musician is the fun, easy, and affordable way to learn guitar, piano, bass, ukulele, and even singing. Just download the app to your desktop, tablet, or phone and start playing. Musician gives you 24/7 access to a vast catalog of video lessons from professionally trained educators, as well as thousands of exercises and songs across dozens of music genres, all tailored to your goals. And with Musician's award-winning technology that listens to you play, you'll get real-time feedback on timing and accuracy so you can actually see yourself improving as you learn. Start your extended 14-day free trial of Musician's Premium Plus package at musician.com/start. That's unlimited access to thousands of lessons, exercises, and songs on as many instruments as you want for 2 whole weeks. Just go to musician.com/start. That's YOUSICIAN.com/start.
So you can, we will maintain the artificially high price of onions, but you need to buy those onions back from us. And then you can sell the onions on the open market and we'll keep the prices up.
Okay.
But if you don't agree to consume these onions within our internal market, we're going to flood the market.
Is this all being done out in the open? Like, is everyone following this in the Wall Street Journal or the Herald Tribune?
People certainly within the Chicago Mercantile Exchange are
the onion community, all the news groups. Rec.arts.onion is all a buzz.
That's right. But as they're doing this, and this is the part that is that's unscrupulous. I mean, it's all pretty unscrupulous thus far. They were storing onions, and those onions were starting to decay.
Yeah, this is a little different than cornering the market on tin or silver.
So they shipped the onions off to something I didn't know existed, which is an onion rehabilitation center. And they paid people.
Wait, what?
They paid people at one remove to strip the gummy outside of the onions off to get like that fresh new onion that's inside of a decaying onion.
I mean, famously, onions have layers and you can do that, but they're going to get smaller. You're going to lose 20% of the net weight of your onion every time you try this little maneuver.
Slightly smaller. But then the onions were shipped back to Chicago from the Betty Ford Center of Onion Rehabilitation. But in the meantime, Siegel and Kasuga had shorted the onion market, which is to say that when they looked forward at the price of onions 6 months from now, a lot of people within the commodities market were seeing this inflated price of onions. They were seeing that onions were now a scarcity.
They're buying onion futures like there's no tomorrow.
That's right. So when Kasuga comes and says, you know, I'm going to...
Shorting is betting against the market.
It's betting against the price. A lot of onion traders were like, oh, for sure, we will we'll make this trade with you because we're expecting the price of onions to go up.
But aren't they like, I'm dealing with this guy who has a lot of control over these two guys have a lot of control over the price of onions. Did they send intermediaries? Did they wear disguises?
Yeah, a lot of this was if you're going to be this surreptitious in your onion dealings, you're also going to have sellers, all these, you know, proxy
shell
sellers.
Companies.
But then people that were monitoring the onion market saw all of these new onions being shipped to Chicago. Now, these onions were old onions that they already possessed, but they were these rehabilitated onions, and they and market observers became aware of what were probably train loads of onions arriving in Chicago. And so the perception of surplus existed. And
which was not inaccurate. They didn't know about the rehabbing, but there were a ton of extra onions out there.
Well, there were just the regular amount of onions. It's just that these two guys bought them all.
I see. They're counting them twice by thinking they're coming back to town.
They're counting them twice, which caused the price of onions to fall dramatically. So by the end of this season, onions were selling for 10 cents a bag.
But isn't this okay for Kasuga and whatever because they shorted the
That's
onions?
Right. Kasuga and Siegel made millions.
Ah.
But by this point in time, it had attracted the attention of everybody in the American commodities. And actually, you know, it was in the newspapers, right, that this was – they had in fact created a real shortage of onions.
Yeah, I was wondering, did this affect the consumer market?
Like, it did.
Supermarkets out of onions, housewives running to the onion table and fighting over the last few remaining withered onions.
That's right. All French onion soup was made out of beets for that season. French beet soup, which is terrible.
Funyuns.
Do not put cheese on beets.
Funyuns were just called f. For
no, a change. They were sadyuns. and this all, a lot of onion farmers went bankrupt because they'd bought these onions back
See,
at inflated
prices.
See,
it's like the
prices.
Housing bubble. These things have victims.
Mm-hmm. Which all of this attracted the attention of the USDA. It attracted government regulators. Government regulators. And a congressman by the name of no less than Gerald Ford.
Really?
Introduced the Onion Futures Act, which prohibited futures trading in onions.
Okay, here's my question at this point. Like, maybe President Ford is, or the future President Ford is not the brightest commissioner on the Warren Commission.
Only as characterized by Chevy Chase.
You think secretly Ford is actually quite a genius, like most Michigan football players.
I mean, the problem with Jesuits is there are two kinds of Jesuits. And one kind of Jesuits is closeted homosexual intellectuals who take the priesthood because that's what happens to the third son in a Catholic family. And the other half of Jesuit priests are football players who couldn't find another job.
Wait, Gerald Ford is a Jesuit Catholic?
No, but this is my experience of Michigan football players.
Oh, I see. Some of them are geniuses.
Some of them are geniuses. Some graduates of Michigan are geniuses, and they're all closeted homosexuals.
Oh.
And then the football players become president of the United States.
This is why Betty Ford opened her onion rehab clinic. She had a lot of sexual frustration.
My feeling about being the president is it requires you to be smarter than the average bear. And so even George W. Bush and Gerald Ford, these presidents that were kind of famously dull.
A little cloddish.
Still to be.
At dinner, they'd be quick and a delight.
They had to be pretty smart to handle just the basic duties of the president. Now, our current president,
yeah, do you still find this to be true?
Is maybe making that a harder case. But, you know, I do feel like our current president has many capabilities, although not an intellectual.
Well, so what I was going to ask is, you know, Gerald Ford's IQ aside, why is he limiting this legislation to onions? What is there about their scheme that is onion specific? To my mind, nothing.
Well, because the onion was the most recent and I think maybe for the first time a commodity that was manipulated so unscrupulously and so illogically, like who would think that onions would be the source of this financial catastrophe?
But it seems like what you should outlaw is the behavior, not the behavior relative. Because what stops these guys from just doing it with broccoli the following year?
Well, good point. But Gerald Ford introduces the Onion Futures Act, and right at the last minute, some representatives of the motion picture industry walk into Gerald Ford's office and say, we would also like it to include outlawing futures trading on movies. rates on movie sales. So
wait,
there was a sense that you could bet against a movie or for a movie while it was in production, which you still can do in Vegas. You can go and say, I think Avengers 3 is going to be a clunker.
Yeah, there's like a, well, there's a fantasy football equivalent of this too, where people draft summer movies, right, and they perform, their portfolio performs according to the movie's box office.
But although you can buy bundled subprime mortgages, you cannot bet on the stock market against Hollywood movies, because the Onion Futures Act became the Onion Futures and Motion Pictures Act.
OFAMPA.
This was just a last minute sort of, this happens all the time in politics, right? Where you walk in and say, but we'd like to also include a clause that makes it illegal to be a cheerleader or whatever. A
little last minute onion trading. So today you could bet on the studio, right? You could short a studio if you think a movie's going to fail.
Well, but
it'll be illegal to create a product.
That just by buying stock, right, in that's Sony, what I mean, or, you know, and you could short it for sure.
But it's still illegal for me to create some Spider-Man portfolio.
Right. Because you cannot buy or sell movie tickets as a commodity.
I was never tempted to do that anyway, to be quite honest.
So this outlawing of onion futures trading devastated the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and this happened in 1958.
Did it leave these guys holding the onion bag, or did they do okay?
It did. All they had left was eggs and turkeys and potatoes, and that just didn't generate the money that onion bags did.
Who knew that onions were the gold was?
And in 1961, they introduced a new commodity to trade. Pork bellies.
Really?
And they said the belly of a pork, which is a pig.
Got it.
Is a commodity, right? It doesn't matter where the pig grows up. It doesn't matter where the pork is being sold. It is, I mean, now, of course, we would have, I don't even know if there is such a thing as a free range pig, but pork bellies at the time were seen as a kind of interchangeable commodity product. And so pork bellies became a thing that revitalized the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And then in 19...
Was pork not being sold as a commodity in any form before?
Pigs, live pigs, and pig carcasses. Well, the pork belly is a thing that you could somewhat standardize, right? A pig and a ham can be various, right? A pig can be big, a pig can be small. You can't just say like pig.
Well, pork belly is specifically the belly meat. It's not all the meat on the pig. It's not the haunches or whatever.
No, it is the bacon, basically.
Right.
And for instance, pork belly is extremely popular in China. Pork belly is a major commodity in Korea.
It's popular with me. It's delicious.
Korea consumes 70,000 tons of pork belly in their cuisine, and prices of pork belly really fluctuate on these markets, because if you have a bad year, if a lot of pigs decide that they're going to work out this season and get real firm,
then the price of Korean samgyeopsal goes through the roof.
Goes through the roof. In fact, the change in consumption of pork and the variation of pork on the market, but it became less and less of a commodity that was traded, and in fact it was delisted in 2011. But this idea of introducing new commodities, so in 1966, concentrated orange juice was introduced as a commodity. It didn't matter where you grew your oranges, orange juice concentrate.
Because it's now been reduced to something.
A kind of flavorless, weird
goop. Cylindrical goop.
And pork bellies and concentrated orange juice, of course, were major plot points in the movie Trading Places, because the whole climax of Trading Places was that our heroes had invested, you know, they got insider information about the orange juice crop, and they were able to go in and manipulate the bad guys.
Oh, right. It's orange juice in that movie.
It's orange juice.
The fake Hunt brothers. I can't remember what they're called in the movie. It's like Ralph Bellamy and
Bellamy brothers. Something.
I can't remember what they're called.
So referencing the Hunt brothers, I think maybe the most famous incident of trying to corner the market in modern times was when these two brothers, Nelson Baker Hunt and William Herbert Hunt, in 1979, decided they were going to try and corner the silver market. They were oil scions. Their father was an oil man down in Texas. And in the course of the year 1979, and really just in the fall, in September of 79, the price of silver was $11 an ounce. And they started to try and corner the market. And it was in all the newspapers, right?
These guys are trying to buy a ton of silver.
They were buying silver right and left. And by January of 1980, they had increased the price of silver to $50 an ounce. And I was 12 years old at the time.
Did you own any silver?
And
did you have a silver doorstop?
I became a real silver bug.
Is that the name for a silver investor? Silver bug?
Yeah, silver bug. People were... we still see the effects today because a lot of family silver, silverware, but also a lot of collectible coins, a whole sort of slice of what would be a world of collectible silver. It all got melted down. People realized.
Such a good price. People were like.
An incredible price. And this quarter had as a collectible of certain value. But just as raw silver, it was worth 10 times as much. So people were melting their old silver candelabra in order to kind of profit from this bubble. But the bubble burst. The price of silver fell back to $11. And what the Hunt brothers had done is they had gone on margin. They were buying silver with money they didn't have.
Other people's money.
And when that all fell apart, they lost a fortune. Of course, they still were rich dudes and ended up only getting a slap on the wrist. But
it's just like the Duke brothers at the end of Trading Places. Were they literally lying in a garbage dumpster?
No, they continued to live in mansions and own lots and lots of stuff.
Isn't that always the way?
Yeah, it really is. The bad side of this story is that commodities trading throughout the 70s was expanded to include things that previously had not been thought of as commodities, including currencies, which it makes sense that currencies would be traded against one another.
Sure.
The value of the American dollar goes up relative to the yen.
Currency trading was not a thing before this?
It was, but not traded as a... currencies went up and down relative to one another, but there weren't markets that were trading currencies as a...
Like futures.
An existential product, right? Or like futures, right? Yeah. There wasn't a futures market in the same way. But then interest rates became a thing that you could buy and sell futures against. You could bet on the stock market indices rather than just on stocks. You could just bet on like how the market was doing. And then, of course, famously, subprime mortgages. But it became the futures market and the commodities market, it was opened up to include sort of anything you could commodify. The way the subprime mortgage thing worked is no one mortgage is anything, but collected an entire portfolio of 10,000 mortgages or 100,000 mortgages becomes an instrument it becomes a commodity instrument. And you can buy and sell futures against whether or not what the market is going to rate that.
Unless it's onions or movie tickets.
Onions and movie tickets remain
the only two things.
The only two commodities that you cannot trade on the commodities market.
And that concludes the Onion Futures Act, entry 867.NU1105. Certificate number 25671 in the omnibus. Now, futurelings, we hope that derivatives markets do not exist in your time.
Well, the idea that they actually keep prices stable is still debatable. Some would say that they do not, that they increase price volatility. Some would say that they stabilize.
That's how you know that economics is just witch doctor science.
Economists argue with one another because they're boring people and no one wants to listen to them.
they try to do this at parties and it doesn't go over. One thing is certain, that in the future it will not be called futures market anymore. It will be called the present market.
Whoa, wait a minute.
Because they will literally be in the future.
Maybe futurelings will be living in the present all the time.
They'll just be so in the moment.
They'll just be like, dude, I don't care what the price of wheat is tomorrow.
What if everyone in the future is in show business and they just talk all the time about being in the moment? Like they don't know the word spontaneous. They just say in the moment.
You and I are in show business. Do we talk about being in the moment?
I don't think we do, and I don't think we are.
We kind of are in the moment when we do this show.
That's true. It's the only time of the week I'm in the moment.
Where you're just like...
it's the only time I'm ever off script.
I'm here.
Be here now. But along with your present market, hopefully social media does not exist.
Boy, I'll say.
In our day, the plague of social media was everywhere. As a result, John and I were at Omnibus Project on every social media platform available to our grubby little fingers. We were individually at Ken Jennings on Twitter and at John Roderick on Twitter and Instagram. We received electronic mail communications, which I need to check, by the way. I haven't looked at the mail in a while.
Oh, boy, I haven't either. Well, you were overseas for a long time.
I've been gone. I've been out of the country. But I should have kept a hand in.
Yeah. I always forget how to get there.
You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. John does not know the password. So maybe either address me or call John and let him know what the password is.
It's bleep blorp.
It's Fnord. That's why he can't remember.
What?
We had a post office box for conventional mail. If you don't want to send us mail of mass destruction, if you just want to send us conventional mail. So I was at the United... this is a totally irrelevant sidebar, but I was at the United Nations last week with my kids touring the United Nations.
Right.
I like the old-timey architecture.
Sure,
it's
I know
fun.
You do.
And...
that building is wide, but narrow.
We had a... It's very narrow. We had a, our tour guide was from Uzbekistan, and she was kind of walking us through all the different instruments and arms of the United Nations do. And there's this kid in the group that is not aware that it's not his own personal tour. And he keeps asking the dumbest questions. And she's talking about deproliferation of nuclear arms. And he keeps asking, but wait, so how do they actually work? Like, how does a nuclear bomb work?
What?
And he's getting increasingly animated. Like, he really needs to know. Like, this, it's this poor Uzbek woman's job to teach him how to make a nuclear bomb.
Right.
And he just can't get his, like, so it kill. How does it kill so many people with fallout too? Like, what is in there that does that? And it's a very awkward situation for the group who just wants to shut this guy down.
Did you not
really
intervene as
no
the as the white dad? Isn't the white dad at that point supposed to go?
If he has a white dad there, it's his job.
No, but shouldn't you grab the other dad by the lapels and shake him and say, "Quiet your child."
I'm not actually sure who he was there with. Maybe he just kind of wandered onto the tour.
You know, my mother doesn't tolerate that type of thing. She'll go right up into a kid's face and be like, "You need to be quiet from now on.
We need your mom there and at every Q&A session ever.
And in every grocery store and in every restaurant where there's an unruly kid.
I want your mom, like, I want your mom to have a ringtone on my cell phone, which is just saying, that's not a question. So at Q&As, I could just play, that's an anecdote. That's not a question.
You know, as an 85-year-old woman, she can get away with murder and does.
That's a lot of moral authority that mm-hmm. she has. Mm-hmm. Why was I even telling the story about the boy who wanted to know how nukes were made? Oh, because we have a post office address. You can send us things. I just checked the mail. A woman from Portland sent us copies of her books, her very funny books, apparently. It's a collection of her zine, Somnambulist. And she sent us several issues of her zine as well.
Nice.
If you're interested in, it looks like this one is about the local grocery and department store, Fred Meyer. So I'm going to be checking that out. Also, somebody sent us these clocks that he or she 3D printed, which are a Mobius strip.
Yes.
Time is a flat circle, and you can see that on these. But I guess the idea is that after going to 12, it does not wrap around to 1, but it goes around to the back of the Mobius strip and starts counting from 13, 14, 15. All the way to 24. And I don't know what you would have to hang the clock somewhere where you could see it from both sides.
I feel like the person should have sent a little bit of an instruction about how they wanted us to use this clock.
We each get one, which is nice.
Yeah, but we've talked about them now a little bit and we're confused about exactly how it's meant to go.
I think if you hang it somewhere where you can see both sides, you just have to spend the first 12 hours of the day on this side of your room.
Right.
And then at noon, you walk around to the other side of the room where you can see the back of the Mobius strip where the numbers 13 through 24 are posted.
If you are going to send us a gift, please do not have that gift require that I do anything.
If you send us a four-dimensional gift... Please, John does not want any non-Euclidean gifts.
Just have the gift be a nice thing and not a thing that has...
That like, makes you move to the other side of the room.
I don't want to have to be ever. Like, oh, this gift obligates me to be over there now.
But when you have thought of these artifacts, you may send them to us at the Omnibus Project, P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155.
Future links from our vantage point in your distant past. We have no idea how long our civilization survived, but surely it will collapse partly in response to some futures market that goes awry.
Or that kid actually getting the bomb.
Right, the kid might get the bomb. He might, the lady from Uzbekistan may explain it to him in great enough detail that he goes and finds some irradiated gold and creates a
3D
bomb.
3D prints a bomb.
Oh, a gold bomb. Gold bomb medicated bomb. we hope and pray that the gold bomb never goes off. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. Also, our recordings are solid gold, so...
Yeah, we're going to put them on a solid gold record. It'll be the last bit of the cube and leave them buried in the earth.
If Providence allows, futurelings, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.